Hey everyone, thanks for listening to my podcasts here on the Hullerstubber feed. Do spread the word to other people if you think they might enjoy them. Do listen to some more if you think you might enjoy them, but do enjoy this one. I am shortly going to be on tour with my new stand-up show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Head to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all those dates. Some of them are sold out, some of them have hardly sold anything. It would really help me if you bought tickets to the ones that aren't sold out. Either way, as soon as you can. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's about cancer and testicles. One of them's not funny, but one of them's really funny, and it kind of cancels out the unfunniness. I'd say just on average, slightly more funny. So I hope you'll come along. If not, keep enjoying the podcast. We'll be back in September at the Leicester Square Theatre with more live podcasts. Maybe a few Edinburgh ones before then. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this stupid podcast you've chosen to listen to.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, and welcome to another Hullerstubber Book Club. Very excited to have Andrew Hunter-Murray with us. We'll be talking about his book, The Sanctuary. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
Lovely to have you on. Hullerstubber listeners will know you as one quarter of No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yeah.
So there's many strings to your bow. You're also an Ostentatious, and you work for Private Eye. Write for Private Eye.
Yeah.
And write novels.
It's
anything I've missed?
No, that's covered it very nicely. Yeah, that's the lot. No more.
So, so tell us about your previous books. I'm guessing you've worked on the QI books.
Yeah,
things like that.
That was my first job at QI. So I joined QI fresh out of university. It was the first job I've ever had, basically. And I was working on a book called The Book of the Dead. Which was biographies of, mini Potter biographies of really interesting people. And I literally just sat in the library for 8 months and read biographies of, Archimedes and Casanova and John Dee and all these amazing historical people. Kellogg, the incredibly weird John Harvey Kellogg. That was a really fun experience, actually. Think about it now. It was a bit weird because we didn't have an office, so I was just writing notes on these biographies and just sending them off and getting feedback sometimes.
I did something not exactly the same but similar. I wrote one of the first jobs I had out of university, which I kind of got off the back of quite a few of my friends working for the publishing house, and I'm trying to remember who it was. I'm not even sure it was, but I ended up writing for the Macmillan, I think it was, the Encyclopedia of the Royal Family. And so similarly, I was going around various libraries and then to Buckingham Palace libraries, which wasn't very good. And then writing these little entries. But then by the time the book came out, the entire Royal Family, it was about 1991. And the entire Royal Family, by the time it came out, the Royal Family had imploded and completely changed.
Oh my
so the book
God.
Was entirely out of date. So yeah, I know a little. My main memory is just trying to falsify my expenses claims and lie about how many hours I worked. They paid really well as well. Right. It was really cheeky. I was very cheeky and always added a few out because no one knows how much you're working. Did you get paid per hour, Andrew, on that?
And if my bosses are listening, it would have been fine if you had, but they didn't, so it's fine.
So I didn't get sacked, but they didn't ask me back to do more. I think I was okay. I was asking for too much money. I've got it. So I managed to find a copy. It's over there. If anyone,
incredible.
I also wrote the West London phone book of 1989 to 90 or 1990 to 1991. I don't know when it came out.
It wasn't really writing, it was just collating people's phone numbers.
Yeah,
that was my first book.
You don't get creative license when you're writing the phone. I think I'll stick a few more. This surname's good. I'm going to try and muck around with a few more first names. Yeah.
Well, I did change Stuart Lee's name to Stuart Wee, but it's a famous story that I've told before. But anyway, this isn't about my early books. And there were other QI books after that.
I was just a research monkey for that one. I wasn't doing the creative stuff, but QI's always got a book or two on the go, which is a really nice thing. You know, we've done the books of general ignorance, and we've done the fact books, and I mean so many. And then when we started No Such Thing as a Fish, we started writing books of the year, which is a kind of digest of everything, all the weird and interesting stuff that happened over the course of that year. That was really fun to do, but a nightmare to research, because you've got to hand in a book about the whole year in September. We did. So that was tricky.
And so is this your second novel,
it The Sanctuary?
So what was the first novel, The Last Day?
Yeah.
Which I haven't read, I'm afraid, Andrew. I have got it. Because it was 99p on Kindle, and I thought,
that's the main
I'll get
thing.
That,
the
and
main
I'll read it at some point.
Is to buy it. The reading is very secondary to an author.
Then I didn't read it yet, but I will read it because I did love The Sanctuary.
Oh, great.
So what was the... I mean, I think I read on Wikipedia that you always wanted to be a novelist or an author. So was it always the intention to...
I don't know who wrote that bloody Wikipedia. It's incredibly brief and incredibly unhelpful. Like, it makes me sound like a complete amateur, and it makes me sound like a swot as well, which I was, but I don't... It's not the main thing that goes on Wikipedia if you were a SWAT or not at school. Like,
it is weird because the first line, well, the first thing is just homework. A quote.
When did I say that? I don't remember saying that. And it's not the most, like, there are about four lines on there about me, and that's one of them. I mean, it's not.
it's the main one. It's the start. It's the it's sort of the sums you up.
But
go and change it, Andrew.
I can't.
I changed mine, and someone's gone on to. Well, I only ever put facts on. If there's facts that are wrong, or if there's a fact that isn't there, I will put it on because it helps people. But someone has gone on to my Wikipedia page, and amongst all the tropes of what I do, it says Richard Herring writes his own Wikipedia page, and then I tried to change it to. But he only ever puts facts on, not opinions. And then whoever put that one on took that off.
God,
so the irony is I thought it was quite funny that I edited that bit, and I thought they would appreciate it, but they were annoyed by me editing. Anyway, enough of that.
I don't want to get into a flame war with the Wikipedia editor, basically, is why I'm too scared to edit it, you know. Oh, dear.
But, so what was the process of becoming a novelist, and how did you get this first book? Because it's done very well as well, we should say.
Well, the main thing is that when I was at school, I always did my homework, and I was a bit of a swot, and that's the relevant thing there. And but I did always want to write a book. I mean, genuinely, I can remember being, you know, I was a big reader from a young age. I always wanted to write something, and I assumed I was going to write something funny because I grew up reading so much Terry Pratchett and Tom Holt and Douglas Adams and Jasper Ford and all these brilliant writers. And I'd written loads and loads of short stories in that kind of vein, which have never seen the light of day yet, although I hope to turn them into something. And then I had this, I took them to a literary agent. A friend of mine said, you should really talk to, you know, a literary agent. You clearly want to write more of this stuff. And so, and she said, I know someone you can talk to. And introduced me to this guy, who's a literary agent. He's called Peter Strauss. And, he said, "Yeah, but I like short stories. But can you write a full novel? Because it's hard to get publishers interested in short stories because people aren't as keen on them. Even when it's Stephen King, you know, a Stephen King novel will sell so much more than a Stephen King book of short stories, even if they're brilliant, you know." And so I said, "Oh, right, novel, okay." And then a few weeks later, I had the idea for the book that became The Last Day, and it wasn't funny at all, but I thought, oh, I like the idea. What would happen? I have to write. I have to know. I have to explore that world. And then that just, it snowballed from there. And I just spent about 3 or 4 months just writing the world. I wasn't writing any story. I wasn't writing any characters. It was literally just what would happen under the, it's a big high concept book, the first one. The world has basically ground to a halt. And half the world is now facing inwards towards the sun. Half is facing out towards the cold, dead universe. And that all happened 30 years ago. So we're now in a Britain which has lived with that and is in the narrow band of habitable territory on the earth. So, yeah, fortunately for the plot. And so I just thought, oh God, what if? And then it all came from there, you know. And then about a year later, I had a first draft, I think, and then sent that off to a publisher. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like, I mean, from this book as well, it feels like you put a lot of research work in it is before you even get into writing, which is certainly confirmed from that first book. Was that the case with The Sanctuary as well?
A little, it was with The Sanctuary. There are always aspects I'm wanting to research and find out more about, if you know what I mean. As in, I don't, you know, the Sanctuary is about, the main character is a portrait painter, and so I did a fair bit of reading about that and about particular paintings and... And it takes place, I read a bit about the islands off the coast of Scotland because it's set on a kind of imaginary island off the coast of Scotland. And so, and I did lots of reading about cults and about the end of the world and existential threats to human life. There are some brilliant books out there about that. So yeah, it's kind of fun, that research phase, because you're just reading and scribbling and getting really excited, and you don't have to make any hard choices about what you're going to follow at that phase. You can just enjoy the world building and the let's try and include some of that, you know. It's a great phase.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I wonder how, I guess most people would do something along those lines, but it feels like if you completely understand the world and have worked everything out in advance, that must make... When I write things, I tend to kind of bowl in. I've always tried to write novels and I get about one chapter in, and probably because I haven't sat down and thought, where's this going? It sort of ends. So I'm sort of fascinated by that, but I wonder whether you're especially fastidious in that due to your research background.
But... The research background probably helps. It probably helps to just marshal all the thoughts about it. But no, because at some point you've got to write an absolutely batshit scenario. And that so you can't be too beholden to the research. Otherwise, you've written a research book. It's a balance, yeah.
Yeah. So how would you, I mean, the big thing with this is I don't want to give anything away because it's a really great book and I was rapt with it, and it's so tense and it's building up, and as a reader, you're trying to work out what the hell is going on. And I don't really want to give anything away about that because I think that's going to be part of the joy of reading it. I mean, we'll talk about the concept and there will be things that come up, but I don't want to kind of give away too much. But so how would you spoiler free describe The Sanctuary?
All right, here we go. It's about a young man called Ben who's traveling across the country somewhere and nearly this country. It's quite near here and it's quite near now. It's not quite either. And he's traveling across the country because his fiance Cara has just written to him from her job. She works on an island off the coast of Scotland for an extremely wealthy, mysterious man called Sir John Pemberley. She's been there for 6 months and she's just written to Ben saying, I know I said I was coming back. Actually, I don't think I am. I think my work here is too important. This is too wonderful a place. So I'm not coming home. Sorry. She writes that to him and he has to find out what's happened, why she's changed so much, why she's become strange like this. And so he thinks, right, I'm going to go to the island. I'm going to find Cara. I'm going to see Sir John Pemberley. I'm going to talk to him, find out what the hell's going on here. And so he sets off and that's the start of the story.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, it has lots of themes and it has a lot of relevance to the world we're living in terms of, I mean, I think the themes that we can talk about, which obviously environmental, it starts with, the elephant's becoming extinct.
Yeah, it's very depressing, that bit. Yeah, it really is.
And, and it's a world, and I guess a big part of it, it's a world where the older people have everything and younger people are sort of working with which, you know, is what is the world we are increasingly living in, where old people accumulate stuff, especially the boomer generation, especially, I think, you know, they've sort of had this lucky life where everything's gone their way. They've had the free education, they've had the free NHS, and then they get into their 70s and 80s and they're just sort of, you know, not caring about the new generation. I mean, as Brexit, I think, shows, doesn't it? I sort of wonder if COVID and Brexit had happened the other way around, whether the elderly might have appreciated the sacrifices that young people made for them and been a bit more happy to give them something back. But it is that, you know, it's that position where for young people now where it's very hard to get on the housing ladder or into jobs or, you know, because all the money's being kept offshore and everything. So that's obviously like a big part,
huge part of it.
Of this.
Yeah, it's a huge part of it. And it's, again, it's, I think, one thing I like to do when I'm writing is I want to take things that are happening in the world today and just turn them up a bit and just take things a little bit further, you know, and see where you end up with. And that's a big aspect of the book is youth and age, because that is happening a great deal in Britain these days. And I'm not saying that all pensioners are wealthy or doing well, because, you know, there are plenty of elderly people who are, you know, destitute in the UK today. But as you say, as an aggregate thing, that is what's happening. And, you know, there are swathes of the population who just have no prospect of getting on the housing ladder. And that's unsustainable. And it's happened within the last 10 or 20 years that shift has really accelerated. And I don't think we've seen the consequences yet. And so the book is an attempt to kind of map out some potential consequences, or, you know, I think, as with The Last Day, so in The Last Day, the world is not going to stop turning, right? I mean, obviously that's not going to happen, even though I researched quite a careful way it could. But in that book, it's about a Britain which is warmer, which is dealing with very substantial migration from overseas, people avoiding the changing climate. And I think those things may well happen in the next 50 years. You know, it's a way of talking about those things without saying they're going to happen in our world, in this version of the world. And you can kind of discuss them in a more interesting way if you're not just saying this is what's going to happen. Also because it's a very grim prospect, and there's a kind of protective layer of sci-fi that you can put around things to discuss the world that exists today. And that's definitely what I've tried to do in The Sanctuary as well. Yeah.
Yeah. It's great. Yeah, I mean, I was as a kid. I mean, I was surprised a little bit how serious it is. Yeah. I mean, it's not, as you say, if you were growing up Douglas Adams and thinking that's the way I'm going to go, this is not like a comedy book at all, really. There's not, you know, there's not, I'm not saying there's no laughs in this at all, but it's not going for the laugh.
No.
It is quite serious. Is that now what you think you want to do? Do you want to do sort of serious sci-fi, or would you branch out into to trying?
I would branch out. I mean, it's interesting because I'm really interested in books that authors wrote when they were expected to do one thing, and then you get like Martin Amis writing a book about video games, gaming arcades, which he did in the 80s when I think it was really quite successful. He's writing a book about how to do really well on Pac-Man. Like I love things like that, and you know, Roald Dahl's cookbook, which I don't think he actually did a cookbook, but you know what I'm saying. I like authors like, I mean, Anthony Horowitz just writes so many different kinds of things, for example.
Yeah.
He writes thrillers, he writes crime, he writes James Bond books, he writes, you know, much funnier books aimed at children. He writes so many different kinds of things, and I really respect that, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's worth doing. Yeah.
Yeah, no, and it's, you know, and of course, you know, we say, as I've said this with other comedians who've written books, and but, you know, comedians are writers, and you are a journalist as well. So, you know, because we associate you with comedy doesn't mean you can't do something serious. I think it's sort of, it's sort of old fashioned in a positive way, I think, the writing of this. It reminded me of the books I liked as a kid, which were by John Wyndham and H.G. Wells. It had a real feel of those to me.
That's highest possible praise. I love John. Yeah. But weirdly, I am right now reading a Wyndham novel which was unpublished in his lifetime.
Really?
Yeah, and also I'd never read it before. It's called Web, and it's about the establishment of a utopian society on a remote Pacific island, so not a North Atlantic one, at least by a millionaire with ideals. And then, I mean, his goes in a very different direction, but oh my god, it's good. Yeah, Wyndham was a master of that kind of stuff. Change one thing, change an aspect of the world. Keep humans the same. That's important. You know, write honestly about human behavior. And they have a lovely, I don't want to trash talk Wyndham at all, but they have quite a starchy quality, as in they were rather disparaging to all cozy catastrophes, you know, Day of the Triffids.
Yeah.
Most of the people he encounters are quite middle class, you know.
Yes.
And so that's an element of it, which I guess has changed, although I don't know how much I've changed it.
But he was, you know, it is those great imaginative ideas that those, you know, and sci-fi is often looked on as sort of not being as, vital or as intellectual as other novels, which are, you know, and Margaret Atwood's one of my absolute favorite authors. Yeah. And I just think, and she's doing sci-fi basically.
Yeah.
And it's extraordinary. And Kurt Vonnegut as well. Absolutely extraordinary authors. And I think luckily Margaret Atwood gets the credit she deserves and Booker Prizes and stuff. But it is quite rare that sci-fi gets that kind of acclaim.
Interesting. Yeah. And you look at, I don't think he would like this characterization, but an author like Kazuo Ishiguro, I mean, Never Let Me Go is effectively a sci-fi book. It's about a very sci-fi scenario, and his latest one, Clara and the Sun, is also a sci-fi scenario. But he's not really focused. He's not focused on the whatever the sci-fi. I didn't want to give away the twist of Never Let Me Go, which is such a good book. But he is writing about a slightly different world. But he's doing that to kind of get at the truth of human relationships. So maybe it's about this sort of ultimate intent of the book, you know, about where people end up being characterized. Like, you know, The Handmaid's Tale is not being told to end up with a sci-fi point of view. But then again, I don't think it matters. Like, good writing encompasses the human and the societies we've constructed and how they might or might not change and how human behavior changes under different circumstances. Like, that's just good writing, you know? So,
you say, it's a great way to, you know, to talk about what's going on and what could happen.
Yeah.
I mean, again, with The Handmaid's Tale, it seems almost like a premonition of what was possibly going to happen. But, you know, it's a way of examining our own world, which I think this book does, your book does fantastically.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm interested in Ben, the main character. Because I wondered if you were a painter. I thought the knowledge of painting was so good, and the vision of what a painter is. I wondered if that was something that you were personally into, or you just researched.
Literally, no artistic skills whatsoever here. I've maybe write books, but in every other aspect, I'm totally, totally uncreative. And so this was, he's an interesting character. I don't think he's completely likable. I think
no, that's what I was going to say. I mean, I think he's there's a sort of, it makes sense in the end, I think, but he's the arrogant. I mean, I think that point where he gets stopped by the border guards and they are obviously going to beat him up unless he does something, and then he refuses. Yeah. He's arrogant and refuses to, and gets beaten up.
Yeah,
sort of sums him up, really. I think
that's a good. I hadn't thought of that particular scene as an indication of his character, but he's not. I like main characters who aren't very likable, and the book's told from his perspective as well, and I really enjoy reading books where you read the story that ostensibly the narrator is telling. They're getting all the shots. They can tell you whatever they like about themselves, and they still manage to come across badly. I love that. I think that's a really fun thing to write.
There's a lot of comedians' autobiographies like that, so, which I've talked about before as well. But yeah, no, I think that is, you know, it is because you are. I mean, in the end, again, without saying what any of the vision is, I sort of had quite a lot of sympathy with Pemberley's ideas. so although the main character doesn't want them to happen,
yeah,
there's a sort of logic behind it that makes sense.
And I that's a relief to hear, because that's what I wanted to do as well. Because you don't, you know, once you make a character wholly bad, where do you go? You know. And that happens in The Last Day too. That one of the things that's happened in The Last Day, that there has been an absolutely monstrous act carried out, which, you know, some people would argue for and would argue was the sensible thing to do. And it's a grotesque act of compromised humanity, which might be necessary anyway. You know, and that's where the crunchy stuff is. That's where the interesting stuff is. You know, people who say, I know this is an awful thing to do, but I think I have to do it. You know, I can't remember which playwright it was who said in a really good play, nobody's in the wrong. And that's hard to write, but if you can, it's.
Well, it is, and at least, you know, I think that certainly a lot in TV stuff and less. I mean, obviously in a novel you get a bit more chance to explore stuff, but in depth. But with TV stuff, there's often so obvious baddies, or just so, you know, the boyfriend character that someone's with is so obviously inappropriate for them,
right.
You know, so wrong for them that you think, well, there's no jeopardy in this.
Yeah,
your girlfriend or boyfriend is deliberately written as being awful, whereas the truth of like changing a relationship or something is that you're in with someone for a reason,
yeah,
and there's got to be a reason you're there,
yeah, exactly. And
obviously it's from your own, it's from one's perspective whether someone's good or bad as well, whether they're doing something to help you or not. Generally, I mean, not with great acts of evil, I suppose, but with, you know, with most things, someone's villain, your boss is only a villain to you because. Yeah. They're telling you what to do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're not a villain to another boss or their wife or their husband,
exactly,
or whatever.
Yeah,
so, so it is. It is a really important thing, I think, to write that. And yeah, I think that's one of the things that I really liked about this book is that I mean, you do. It's not like the narrator character is such an idiot that you don't care what happens to him. But like him, you want to find out what is going on. Yeah. And I suppose that level of the character he has is the reason that he pushes through, where other people might just go, oh, okay, this is all right. I'll sit back. His wanting to know and his desire to as I suppose as the artist, his desire to sort of see the whole person.
Yes, exactly. And the kind of Pemberley, the Sir John Pemberley, who owns the island, and the island itself, are kind of symbiotically linked. You know, finding out the truth about one is finding out the truth about the other, and that's and as because he's a painter, he tries to make honest depictions. He's a very compromised character as well. Like, his job is to paint the wealthy. His job is to paint people living in the enclave villages which Sir John Pemberley established and where the wealthy have mostly withdrawn to. He goes around effectively giving the rich idealized versions of themselves. He has compromised a lot of his ideals on the way to where he is now. And so the book is partly him slightly reaching the end of his rope there and saying, I can't quite compromise this far, you know, this far and no further.
Yeah, no, it's very, very interesting stuff. Yeah, again, I think without giving too much away, I mean, I think I was interested whether the biology, without going necessarily into what it is, the biology of what is going on and how much that is based on fact and possibility and how much you've created stuff around that is the scenario that turns out to be in the book
possible.
Is it possible,
you know,
possible. But is it based on anyone's particular research?
I don't think anyone's proposed the exact thing that I've suggested is going on, thank God, because that is a good reason. I think I found a novel mechanism for this particular oh God, it's so hard to talk about without, because that's like a last 50 pages thing of the book is where it all starts really kicking off. Yeah, but I'm interested in those questions of.
I mean, it's something that people are researching in that general area.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
So it's about DNA and all that sort of stuff, and what we can do with that. I think we can say without giving too much away. But I mean, the end of the book. I mean, even just saying there's loads of twists in it, sort of is almost a spoiler. But it does. There's sort of so much. There's so much stuff that happens in the last 50 pages that it's one of those books you sort of think I might have to go back and read it all again just to get the wealth of stuff that's happened there. But yeah, it is, you know, it's a real it's quite a slow burner, I think, isn't it, Andrew? And I think then everything sort of tumbles
apart. There's a fuse and there's a barrel of dynamite, and then
and that's what's really good about it, because the tension of, you know, I really really enjoyed going, what the hell is happening, you know. It's not ambling along. It's very enjoyable, but it's going. It's a slow burn, and then it is very explosive stuff. And you're left with a lot of questions and a lot of, you know. And it's always nice when something ends. I don't think you'll write a sequel. You could do a sequel, but you're not. I don't think it's a sort of sequel ending, but it's an ending where the reader is left to imagine quite.
Oh,
a lot
definitely.
Well,
so. I really like those, you know, books like that, which.
Yeah.
Give you a lot of. In fact, Handmaid's Tale actually, it ends, I think, with her being bundled into the van, doesn't it? And then you don't know.
Because then there is a sequel, though, isn't there?
Oh,
so
yes.
Then it isn't. So she did. I mean, I think that's it. It is. And the sequel is good as. I mean, she's. I mean, Margaret Atwood, I couldn't.
Yeah, she's a dog.
As we talked about in the Rallister, I have a lot of time. And I deeply regret spending a lot of time talking about wanking people off with her writing machine. Because I'll never get to talk to her. I can't talk to her now, can I?
No, I don't think I can either. I think I'm also implicated. So, you know, we've both managed to cut ourselves off from one of our heroes. Yeah.
But there we go. Another thing I liked about the audiobook, and I'm not sure, I don't think it's in the book, is you've got a little extra where about some of the books that influenced you.
Yeah.
Which is a really nice touch. The Philip Pullman one sounds great, which I wasn't aware of.
Yeah, Demon Voices is an incredible book. And it's a book about storytelling. And he writes about story mechanics, basically. And he's a really interesting author, because his the Northern Lights trilogy, I think he was in his late 40s or early 50s when they were published. Like, he wasn't a 25-year-old out-of-the-blocks author. He'd written lots of books before, really good ones. But it was kind of like that was the culmination of lots of other things he'd been writing about. And Demon Voices is a collection of lots of articles about stories, speeches he's given about stories, you know, various different media. He's, you know, introductions to books and afterwards and things like this. But you kind of get a sense of what he thinks is important in story, and in particular in a fantastical story, the kind he writes, in another world, you know, where his particular values are. He's quite rude about Tolkien, which is quite funny. and he also says it's okay, you know, the primary purpose that you should be writing is to make money, to live on and support your family if you have one, and that's allowed, and you're allowed to represent yourself as a writer who needs to actually make a living from the thing you're doing. Take yourself seriously. Which is, it's really encouraging to read, you know, you think,
well, it is hard to make. I mean, I know you've got the Last Day, you've sold the film rights for that,
under
offer.
It's a sort of tangential thing where it's being developed at the moment, and it's been worked out. I think I'm allowed to say I've read a pilot version of the script, which is incredibly exciting, and so that's really thrilling. And you just, you know, lots of these things don't come to pass, and if they do, it takes several years, and so you just have to. If anyone's interested in turning it into something else, that's amazing, and you just have to be glad of the interest and, you know, do what you can to help it along, but also not say, oh, right, it's definitely going to be a film and we're going to be writing The Last Day 7 in 30 years time or whatever it's going to be. that's happened, which is very nice.
But it's, you know, so that's it is pretty tough to make a living writing books, though. You know, I would have thought, especially with not, you know, just especially with something that you've, like you say, you're investing that all that time before you've even really got, you know, you might invest all that time and create a world and have an idea and then go, this doesn't work at all. I fucked it up. I suppose it's the more time you spend on, the less likely that is. But,
well,
you know, the initial idea has to be good enough for you to know that it's worth spending a year developing.
Yeah, but it, I mean, things don't come off sometimes. You know, I stopped writing the last day, I think once or maybe even twice. I just couldn't see a way forward with it. And I wrote the first 30,000 words and then they weren't any good and I gave up. I had to start again from scratch. You know, it happens. And after the last day, I started writing another idea for a world, which just didn't quite come off. And I'd written nearly 20,000 words of it. And I thought, it's a bit too grim, this world. It's not quite in the spirit of the kind of books I want to be writing. And so I just put it to one side and that's, you know, it's, so it does, it's not very encouraging, but it does happen. Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, but there's a lot of people will be trying, you know, even if you get published, which is obviously a massive hurdle to overcome in itself, most authors are, you know, not selling, more than 1,000 books in hardback. And, you know, that's not going to make them any actual money.
No, exactly. So, it's a constant, you know, the hurdles always lead to something else. You have the idea, then you've got to write the book, which is hard. Then you've got to get a publisher interested, which if it's the best book ever, might be incredibly easy and you get 25 publishers bidding war within a day. Normally doesn't happen. That doesn't happen very much at all. And then once it's out, you've got to tell people about it and hope it sells and then hope you get, you know, enough interest to write the next one, which hopefully you're already working on. But yeah, every good thing is tricky to get and then also leads to something else, which is also hard. So, but it's also so much fun. I mean, it's what a treat, what a thrill to have made up a world and then to have people talking to you about it saying, didn't think much of Ben, you know, or whatever, or what's Bianca doing? You know, that kind of, like, that is a real thrill. It's lovely.
Yeah. Well, it is that, you know, and when it's good and when, you know, it does feel like, you know, and that's what I love about imagination generally, whatever it is, it feels, even though none of these people are real and even though it's absolutely just some words on a page, you really do have visceral feelings about all of these characters. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's when writing is great. I mean, hopefully most people who are writing novels are managing to do that, but it is sort of bizarre when you think about how invested you can get, you know, or in anything. It could be a TV show, could be a comedy show, could be anything, but you get invested in those characters to that extent that, you know, that you can actually slightly forget they're not actually real people.
Doesn't matter at all. But that's I really like this thing about writing, which is if you read something that's good enough, it doesn't matter where or when it was written. You are connecting with the author who might have been dead for 200 years, but it doesn't matter because the stuff is good and you're laughing at a joke that, you know, for example, I'm in ostentation. I'm a huge fan of Jane Austen. Laughing at a joke that Jane Austen wrote in 1807. That's insane, but it's a good joke and the character is beautifully drawn. Edith Wharton as well, I'm a huge fan of. Like, she writes incredible people. You know, her characterization is just so strong. You have to have an opinion about these characters as you're reading them and you really want them to succeed or to fail. And it's, it's glorious, but it's surreal.
And on a level of being a writer, I mean, you do so many different things. And obviously, I've found that writing a book is the hardest of all the things that I do. And I've not written novels, which I would imagine is harder. How are you fitting all those things in? And how do you allocate your time to writing a novel? Are you putting days aside or are you just
first thing in the morning when my brain is nice and fresh and just before the rest of the day has started? Because I find in my experience, once I look at my emails, I'm stuffed. You know, because then the world's got a little like hook in you and you think, oh yeah, I haven't written that sort of two paragraph thing I needed. Oh, and I haven't done that. Whereas when you're just, you know, fresh up in the morning, you can just kind of slip into the world a bit more easily and imagine it more. And so, the both books I wrote exclusively before 10 a.m., I'd say.
Right.
and slowly, you know, it can be an hour a day or it does, it's not, you know, and some days you mess up and you get up late and you don't get that hour. And then I'm very ratty for the rest of the day because I think I've kind of left everyone in limbo on that planet I'm writing where I really should have checked in with them. And, you know, but it is, but, you know, if you can write 1,000 words 100 times over, you've got a first draft.
Yeah.
It's,
yeah. I mean, there's that element where writing is sort of seems so difficult and like starting from nothing, you know, even or just starting from an idea that I've got to do so much to do. But it's absolutely true that, you know, that when you read a book, even, you know, you think you read a chapter and you read it in, you know, 10 minutes or 15 minutes, it's not that many words really. And then it's, you know, obviously it takes crafting to get there, but it's getting it down, isn't it? It's sitting. I mean, I think that's, it wouldn't work for me because before 10 o'clock, I'm wiping bums and being shouted at by a 4-year-old being puked on. But yeah, I mean, I guess it's finding your own time that it would work.
Exactly,
you know, my wife who writes kids books, wrote her first book in a lunch hour at the job she was at,
that's,
you know,
amazing.
The desk. Yeah. I think she had time at the desk, but mainly in a lunch hour.
That's great.
And, you know, and I think that's it. If you've got that time and you really, you know, you've got to really want to do it, right? You've got to really be invested in what you're doing and think there is something here. And I think it's about not, you know, that advice that you should try and make money is, or not be ashamed of making money is correct. I think you've got to just write something you think, whatever happens.
Yeah.
I just need this.
You've got to write it
out there.
Yeah.
And then if I can make £1 million from it.
Oh, fabulous!
That'd be quite nice.
But it's kind of relaxing knowing that you probably won't, though. It kind of frees you up a bit.
Yeah.
Because no one does. You know, Ian Rankin, J.K. Yeah. Rowling. You know, a few others. That's it. And and that's all right.
but it's, you know, it is, it's just, it's an astonishing thing. And again, I think if you'd go back to you as a child and say you will have written however many of these books and the two novels, and if that was it, you'd be overwhelmed.
I'd be thrilled.
With amazement.
I'd be so excited, yeah.
So it's you know, it is, it's an incredible thing. Look, it's a really great book. I'll ask you a couple more questions, then I'll let you go. So you talked about having another idea on the go. Are you working on a third novel as we speak?
Yes,
I am. A fourth or fifth novel?
I've written a lot of a third one, and I've had an idea for a fourth, which is now starting to drag my attention away. But
okay,
it's just not very helpful. They're kind of stacking like planes above Heathrow. They're just sort of waiting. I've got to get the third one off onto the ground safely.
Yeah,
and then I'll properly start working on the fourth. But yeah,
and are you in the situation where you know that will be, your publisher says we'll publish that, or is your publisher waiting to see it, or would you have to put it around all the publishers again, or will it, is it are you solid enough?
I've been signed up to write another book for the same publishers. So depending on whether they really like or really hate the idea.
Yeah,
you know, nothing's guaranteed, but yes, there will definitely be a third book from me in this. I kind of, because the first two books in this that I've written are kind of slightly changed versions of Britain, and they're, you know, they're slightly depressing. The next one I want to be a fair bit less depressing, you know, not depressing. I mean, sell it, Andy. but you know, they're sort of visions of things which haven't gone completely right. You know, path this country has taken, which have taken it on a slightly darker path. Anyway, I want the three together to be something called the Altered States Trilogy. I just think that's a nice sort of loose banding of three different visions of this world and where it might go next, you know.
And are you reading anything at the moment you'd like to recommend? You've recommended a few books already, but is there anything at the moment you're reading that you...
What am I reading at the moment? So I'm reading Web by Wyndham, as I said. And I've just been on a bit of a binge at the library. I'm reading White Sargasso Sea by John Rhys, which I'm quite enjoying, but I don't think I fully understood it yet. I'm not very far into that. And what else? There was something else I'm reading. God damn it.
I find it quite hard to read more than one thing at a time, I have to say, but yeah, what's
well, I'm reading a book called 4,000 Weeks by Oliver Berkman, who is a brilliant writer about time and productivity, and it's a book about how 4,000 weeks is the average human lifespan, which is a terrifying and depressing, isn't that horrible? 4,000 weeks, first 2,000 of those you're being educated, you know, and like, so I'm definitely nearly at 2,000 weeks of life I've already had.
Right.
And it's about how, you know, productivity is a bit of a myth and a curse, and you have to live sanely. You have to say, well, I'm not going to get all this done. And you have to slightly say goodbye to the, you know, how to get it all done. You can't just accept that. And then you'll start making meaningful choices. But unfortunately, due to my life, I've only made it about 40 pages in, and I've stopped about 2 months ago, and I'm struggling because I'm too busy.
Very good.
It's really good.
Very good.
First 40 pages.
I mean, like, as you get older, as well, a week is so fast, you know, like bin day comes around so fast, or snooker day comes around. So I think it can't be. I must be doing this on a different day than usual. So it's the weeks go very fast. Is there a genre you prefer? Do you like reading novels more? Because I kind of think I prefer factual books.
Sure.
And generally, I don't read many novels. But do you read?
I read so much nonfiction for my work at QI that I when I'm trying to relax, I almost always read fiction. Yeah. So I read a lot, but within that, a pretty kind of Catholic taste. So I'll read anything really. Lots of, you know, fair few thrillers, fair few crime, lots of literary stuff. Because I studied English, I have this sense of wanting to knock off loads more of the classics, which I never got around to during my degree. So I got a few of those stacked up. And
great.
Yeah, I try, and don't always succeed, to read one absolute slammer, you know, top 20. These are the books you must read before you die each year. So it was Middlemarch last year, and then The Count of Monte Cristo the year before that. Normally absolute doorstops as well. Might try Mice and
Men. Middlemarch, I got the audiobook of Middlemarch for exactly the same reasons.
Oh my goodness.
I couldn't get into it at all as an audio, but I think I was saying to you before that I think some audiobook, did you read your own audiobook, which is great. Yeah. Though it makes me picture you as the main character, and you in Jane Austen clothing is what makes me picture it. Though I can't picture anything that fantasy. I tried Middlemarch and I could not make head nor tail of it as an audiobook. So I might have to
read that one.
With yours, I read, because I didn't have the audiobook to begin with. So I read some of it and then did the audiobook and the rest of it. And it was nice to read again. Actually, I read in. You know, I the nice thing about this podcast is I'm ingesting a lot of books, mainly through audio, but it reminds, you know, when I go on holiday, when I used to before we had kids, I would read a book a day, and then not really read much when I got home. And you can think, why am I not? Why am I not reading? I really like reading.
Carve out the time. It genuinely is. Writing, as in I have a commute to work where I have a 20-minute train, and that's great because as long as I don't open the computer or the phone or whatever, I think it's got 20 minutes to read. You can make good headway there, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's true. Well, look, thank you so much for your time, Andrew. I thoroughly recommend The Sanctuary. I'm going to check out The Last Day as well. Thanks so much for coming on to talk to us. Good luck with your new novels. Thank you to Chris Evans, Not That One, for fantastic production. We've got everything working again. It hasn't been working very well, Andrew, in the last couple of weeks. A couple of these I haven't been able to hear what person's been saying. So, you know, I'm looking forward to listening to those ones. But I heard every word today. So thank you very much. We'll be back next week, I think, with Alice Roberts talking about Buried.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks very much for listening to the podcast. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for fantastic downloads and books, and to join the Go Faster Stripe Club and get loads of stuff from really interesting comedians. Help little Chris Evans Knock That One out. That would be lovely. All right, RichardHerring.com for all my gigs. Hope to see you at a gig. Come and say hi after if you've enjoyed these podcasts. Don't come if you haven't enjoyed them and say you haven't enjoyed them. It'll make me feel sad.